Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Abraki, and I'm conducting an interview with Terry Linkletter, International Technology Authority and Leader in Professionalism, Coach, Microsoft Information Technology, Board Director, the Institute for Certification of Computer Professionals, and a past Senior Quality Assurance Manager, Microsoft Business Group Center of Excellence. Terry, you bring a lifetime of proven world-ranking international business and technology leadership and professionalism to our audience. Considering your very busy schedule, we thank you for doing this interview with us.
Stephen, thanks for the chance to talk to you.
What were the catalysts that led you into computing?
I don't think it was very different for me some 40-odd years ago than for young people today getting into computing. I always enjoyed playing with Erector sets in my day, probably Legos today, building things that did things and like putting together a strong lifting crane or something like that. In my case, I did not have computers in the home, of course. Computers were in hidden rooms, and they were often multiple rooms for a single computer. But I was lucky that after my freshman year in college, I got to work on a summer internship with the federal government, which at the time was kind of a program that was under President Johnson. And my job was to learn to program. Oh, get paid to do this? So I was learning from a textbook and building analytical software in Fortran and just falling in love with the fact that there was this $2 million toy that was carrying out my every command, right or wrong, but I only got to run my programs once a night, so I spent a lot of time desk checking. It was just fun. I think that was why I got into it.
Can you profile your current role at Microsoft?
Right now I'm a coach for software development teams. This is a way where I get a chance to work across the organization. I think I got the best job in the world. I get to work with some very brilliant people and give them some pointers, which are actually fairly thorough, well-documented pointers, on how they can make better estimates of what it will take to complete a given project and end up with better software quality, fewer bugs, as well as better performance, better user interface, and so forth.
You know, Terry, you've been doing this for a long time and just an incredible history of success and passion for the industry and for the profession and so forth. So I want to sort of delve into all of that wisdom you have. Can you share your insights into the computing profession in the 1970s and 1980s?
Yeah, okay, looking back, it is a bit hard to remember pre-internet. Let's see, the ARPANET, the predecessor to the internet, had just transmitted its first message in 69, which consisted of the word LO, L-O. It crashed after the first two letters of the word login. At the time, computers were typically in glass-enclosed rooms. We had gone out of the hidden back room into a situation where people were very proud of having this big investment that was working so hard for them, and so tourists would come by and watch the tape drive spin. Timesharing had just become a real possibility for companies all across the world, where a single hunk of iron was going to be able to service multiple users concurrently. Each user wouldn't realize that they were only getting part of the processor. But it was a time when companies were developing their own financial systems from scratch in COBOL, each one a little bit different. Let's see, then in the late 70s, the mini-computer revolution had begun. Still, the client-server model was in its infancy, so people would work with the mini-computers just as they had with the mainframes on a time-sharing basis, and networks were not standardized. They were manufacturing, the particular manufacturer would have their own network for their computers. And then in the 1980s, the microcomputer was springing up, and it was taking root in companies without central approval of the Central Information Systems Organization, which made them worry that the companies would end up with anarchy, that they wouldn't be able to talk to each other, that all these little systems would be doing different things that wouldn't roll up well to the big picture. And that was why the manufacturers of the microcomputers and the software, such as Microsoft, were able to have such an influence across the companies, because that was where the standards began to come from. So the world had gone from a very strong central organization to a very diverse and freedom-based market, which I think has shown itself to finally come together now, where the computers are working in synchronicity through the cloud to a point where we are really ending up with standards that work worldwide.
That's an incredible history you shared with us. And, you know, you also have this just an amazing background in software and software engineering. Can you comment on how software engineering has developed in the practitioner world?
Yeah, let's see. Software engineering was a term that actually was coined in 1969. Prior to that, we talked about some very specific roles. There was the analyst, systems analyst, who would try to decipher what was needed and put it together in a model that the programmer could then develop and design from. And early on, there was even a coder who would take the programmer's pseudocode and put it into the specific instructions in the machine language or the assembly language or later COBOL. The great strength of COBOL was that now the programmer could directly record the steps in a way that even an analyst could read it and make sure that it was doing what they expected it to do. That of course, has all changed quite a bit. But there was also a tester role that gradually developed. It was a come-along later insight that you really needed to have a professional be the one who was responsible for validating that the software did what it was supposed to do with very careful test cases. The process for estimating was pretty much by guessing from prior experience. Now we have techniques which allow us to make that a much more detailed process. We didn't have object-oriented, and that meant that we often had different places where we kept conascent or relevant information. If you made a change to how a variable got initialized, it was probably in a different place from where that variable was getting used or incremented or then put out to pasture. And so the maintenance of software required some knowledge of the structure of a particular piece of software. Now with object-oriented, we centralize all of that into a single module and are much better able to view our development as consisting of pieces in which each piece has its own responsibilities. Reusability was something where we simply would go try to read similar programs and steal as much of the code as we could instead of the current situation where there are these wonderful libraries that do 90% of the work that has to be done in developing a new application. They sit on the shelf as part of what we have when we get the software language, and we just pull them out and use them, and the maintenance of all those parts is very centralized, not just in our company, but in the world. So Microsoft maintains its APIs and libraries. Yeah, it's been quite a development process as we've gone from not really having an engineering discipline to real software engineering where we're building with reusable parts.
So there's also this sort of aspect of rapid iterative development and ubiquitous platforms. Do you have any additional comments on those?
Oh, good point. Initially, we had these huge projects where we would have the system analyst come in first and lay out an entire requirements document of perhaps hundreds of pages and then turn it over to the programmers who would work away for a long time, often on large teams. And the problem was that by the time you delivered, the requirements would be different, what the user really needed. So with rapid iterative development now, it's very common for as little time as a few weeks to be spent in producing something that the user will actually be able to use and reflect back and tell you whether it's working well, whether it really meets their needs, how their needs are changing as a result of having the tool in their hands, so that you can then with them prioritize what the next step will be to give them what they next need. That's turning out to be very successful. Ubiquitous platforms, let's see. The situation before was that you were developing for a computer, or, you know, it might get upgraded over time. But now you have computers that will run your software everywhere, and it's much less important where it runs than the job that it will do for people. So you can think of the computer as being almost insignificant, whereas before it was the center.
So what are the differences between information technology organizations and developing software for sale?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of similarity, of course, but it does make a huge difference to know your customer, your end user, directly versus developing software that will be empowering a whole class of customers or users, but that you don't know any one of them directly to see exactly what they're going to do with your software. In the first case, you tend to develop something that is more specific to the need or that offers the ability to that end user to parameterize and change their experience within certain restrictions. But in the latter case, that's the whole story. You want to make sure that you're giving your end users something that is very empowering, that they can tailor easily, almost unthinking, to the way they work. So the latter turns out to be much more challenging to me. You have to do your market research up front to understand the way a whole class of users works, and then apply that to the generality of the system you're delivering.
You know, again, considering your very rich background, can you define what you would consider to be the half-life of useful computer knowledge?
Half-life of knowledge. Here we're not talking about a cool interactive multiplayer shooter computer game, right? Half-life? No. We're talking about the fact that some information is almost immediately useless after you've learned it. That certainly is true of our industry. And other information is much more persistent. So, for example, the tricks that I learned for editing punch cards, inserting a new column as I was duplicating an old card, only served me for maybe a decade. And the octal representations of machine language for a given computer only served for a few years. But, for example, something perennial now is that software design principle, which says when you're building code, you want to minimize the coupling between your modules so that they're relatively independent of each other, and maximize the cohesiveness within a module, how everything relates within that module. And I have seen no hint of that principle becoming irrelevant, even though it does present itself differently in object-oriented versus procedural programming versus logic programming with Prolog or some similar language where you're working from rules. And I think that the half-life has probably been fairly consistent over my career, less than 5 years for sure. You really have to stay on top of your learning. So if you're in a certification program, you really want to continually recertify, getting the training that you need in order to stay on top of what's happening in the trends of the industry.
So what are the differences then between working at big companies and at internet startups?
Yeah, I have done both. Both have their thrills. Before Microsoft, I was at a small startup for about 5 years. Here at Microsoft, I have a huge community of experts that I can call on, and each of them has a strong sense of good corporate citizenship, which here means that if you have a question, you can find an email distribution list that will get you the answer. You just ship it out to that list, and there may be hundreds of people who are seeing your question. Many of them will simply let it go and continue with their work. Others will pick it up and give you a response that is right on target so that you waste very little time. And overall, the experience is one of a really strong community, but participating to the level that your particular situation lets you. If you have a lot going on, then you may not even be looking at that distribution list to look for questions that people might ask that you could answer. But if you have some time, then you do check in. But at a small company, you have another offsetting benefit. You get to help make the directional decisions that really affect how that company will do in the marketplace. So you're helping the marketing people as well as the engineering people looking across the company. Even in quality assurance, my specialization, I was able to help the marketing people understand the product more deeply and see the characteristics of the audience that they were trying to reach. That's a thrill, too. It's like having the larger ship and being able to take on different roles within the crew. Maybe you get to be helping steer at some point, and you get to be in the engine room at a different point. You're much more specialized in a large firm.
So, you know, when will careers in computing disappear?
I don't know. We might stop calling it computing sometime. But you see new specializations of our profession appearing all the time. I mean, if you look at what computer courses are being offered in schools now, you can see social computing and human-computing interaction as specializations, business intelligence, data warehousing, or even bioengineering within the computing department. But you also see a lot of computer application going on. A person is trying to decide what to major in, they will want to look at the application of the computing knowledge that they would like to become specialized in and consider majoring in that area rather than in computing itself. But if you're going to be going into game programming or information assurance or security, computer science is still the right place. It's a huge umbrella now of terminology that will, there are so many disciplines even within computing now. You have computer engineering and information systems, software engineering, as well as computer science and data administration.
I see. So the sort of the natural evolution of, you know, where computing is going and the profession itself.
Well put.
I guess this leads me to this whole idea now as IT as a profession. You know, increasingly there's attention given to this with recognized professional certification, adherence to a code of ethics, demonstrated professional development, alignment with the body of knowledge and best practices. And these concepts are encapsulated in IT professionalism, really IT being a profession. Can you share your views on IT professionalism?
I think you have captured what it means to be a professional or to have a true profession. I would also add the recertification as well as the professional certification that keeps the community of professionals on tap with the latest knowledge. And we see that going on in all other recognized professions. Over time, for example, the law profession has developed all of these characteristics, even though at the time of Abraham Lincoln, anybody who wanted to pick up a law book and learn it themselves could become a lawyer. This is no longer true. And I think that this will, the same changes will be occurring in computing as they have in certified public accounting or engineering. We have had several strong movements in our profession. In 1973, there was a movement by all of the major associations of professionals, including the Association for Computing Machinery and the Canadian Information Processing Society, as well as the Data Processing Management Association and others, to form a certification process that they gave to an institute that they set up, the Institute for Certification of Computing Professionals, where I sit on the board. And that has had all of the aspects that you mentioned for professionalism, recognition that you're part of the profession by putting the designator after your name. The IEEE Computer Society, the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers Computer Society, has a certification that works in the same way, the Certified Software Development Professional. And now, in 2009, there is a new movement that is finally going to be coming to a practical introduction of worldwide certification. And it seems to me that this is the right direction for our profession. The International Federation for Information Processing, IFIP, has their IP3 program, the International Professional Practice Partnership, which has already set up programs. Actually, I think it's the Canadian Information Processing Society and Australian Computer Society, and they're in the process right now of finalizing the approval for the British Computer Society. Also a member is the IEEE Computer Society. So we will be seeing around the world a common means of recognition of members of our profession, which will be encouraging all of us to continually keep up to date. I'm looking very much forward to seeing that succeed.
So as you indicated, I guess the IFIP IP3 program sort of marks an historical inflection point in that, you know, for the first time we have IT as a global profession, and you don't have that even in the other professions where you can get a designation and in one country and it's transferable throughout the world. So it's quite a remarkable achievement, and really with IT providing that sort of thought leadership in a very practical sense.
That is well put. This is a case where computing may be late to the party of professionalism, but you're going to be taking the leadership.
Well, we now have a unique opportunity to drill into the accumulated wisdom from a very accomplished executive and leader. And if you could sum up your life experiences with career tips for the ICT professional, what would be your tips and the reasons behind them?
Okay, well, let's set expectations then for the person just getting into the profession. It's really not like chess. It is almost always much more a team sport where you have the people who are specialists in various arenas working together to solve a problem that will really help a lot of people. So you need all of the specializations from understanding how people think and build. And so when you build the computer-human interface, you're making sure that it is just a natural extension of the way they like to work, all the way down to the very specific numerical methods that you need in order to make sure that the results that you give them are accurate on a digital computer. Another thing that I noticed is that it's important not to get stuck in a particular position. There is so much to learn and do that it is advisable that a person continually be analyzing where they would most like to work. That might mean different specialties in the same company. You often see a person who starts as a computer software tester and becomes enamored of the actual development of the software and watches and learns and goes back to school and becomes an excellent software engineer. And then they take what they have learned from testing and put it to work in the software engineering to be able to verify and even prevent defects. And then finally, you might see them mature and become a program manager or become an analyst who works in the business and does the interface between those who are going to be using the system and those who are developing it. That's where I think the skills are most important of all. You have to be an interpreter of different languages, make sure people's minds are in sync. And I would also recommend that people join a professional association. Find the one that's appropriate for you and meet with other professionals regularly, both within your company as well as in the association across organizations. So become certified and continue to recertify through professional development opportunities.
Terry, that's just a great sort of series of tips for ICT professionals, and I really appreciate that. We're at the end of the interview here, so, you know, with your demanding schedule, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview with us, and we really do thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Thank you very much for the chance to talk. It's really kind of fun to look back and look forward as well.
I am Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Terry Linklater, International Technology Authority, Leader in Professionalism, Coach, Microsoft Information Technology, Board Director for the Institute for the Certification of Computing Professionals, and a past Senior Quality Assurance Manager for Microsoft Business Group Center of Excellence.